Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
The following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
Welcome, you're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. I'm sick, Tim.
That's what I hear.
Oh my God, I picked up some disease. I don't know what it is. Ghosty disease. My head is filled with ectoplasm from the haunted location I just visited as we filmed our first episode of the new program I'm a part of. And I'm excited about that. But while I was away, Tim, something happened. Another program aired.
Yeah, that's what another, I hear, yeah.
Another program on the Travel Channel. It's from a Canadian production company. They hit me up a year ago. They're like, hey, would you want to come tell your haunted hospital story? And I said, sure. I'd love to come tell my haunted hospital story. Well, I only just got to see the episode yesterday when I got home from my film shoot, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I saw a clip that they were playing online, and I had to reach out to you. Because you were represented, they clearly say his co-host and producer, so we know there's only one of those.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah.
And you were the actor. I mean, it was uncanny how much I looked like me. The guy that played me was uncannily identical. Same glasses, same, you know, amazing haircut and goatee. And I'm like, I don't know how they could make anybody else look as closely, you know, as the actors to the human being, because usually you watch these shows, right? And
right.
You see the actors are these roguishly handsome people, and then you see the real people and they look nothing like the actor that portrayed them. But I thought they got me right until I saw the actor they picked for you. I couldn't have asked for a better representation of you on television, Tim. Your first time on TV.
Yeah.
You were represented by a 6'5" black man that looked like he could play football for, I don't know, not the Vikings, because
no.
This guy looked like a winner.
No, yeah, yeah, he did. He was impressive. I was impressed.
Yeah, yeah. So I thought that was kind of funny, mm-hmm, that that's the representation of you they chose, a 6'5", well-sculpted black man, because, again, they were channeling your inner totem.
Well, Dave, Tim, you know, it does run in the family. My stepdad's African-American, and I figured that is somehow,
you know, that's not how it works, right?
No, it isn't? No.
No, Tim, that's, you know, step parents are great. Don't get, I'm one.
Yeah.
But no, when it comes to that idiosyncrasy, you don't actually absorb part of their DNA because they're your step parent.
That doesn't hand down that way?
No. Oh. But I'm sure Pops would have enjoyed the fact that you were really represented more his son in that episode than anything else.
I think he got a good laugh up in heaven, that's for sure.
So, okay, so here's the inconsistencies, of which I can't understand any of this. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Let me do this. Usually we banter and we don't bring in the guests, but I've got to hear our guests' thoughts on this as well. Today we've got an interesting topic. David Bowie, UFOs, witchcraft, cocaine, and paranoia. The occult saga of Wally Elmar. I'm sure I'm butchering the name.
Elmark.
That's it. The rock and roll witch of New York. Joining us, one of our favorite guests, Timothy Beckley, is back. So, Tim, or do you prefer Timothy? What do you want me to call you?
Tim. Just Tim.
Okay. So, Tim number two, we're watching this episode. Yes. I'm based here in Minnesota. That's where Tim Dennis, Tim One, and I live. So, I tell them the story. They represent it as though it takes place in a upper New York State hospital. First of all, I don't even understand why you'd need to change that. Then they represent Tim as a 6'5" black man. My girlfriend, they renamed Claire. Again, the inconsistencies I just don't understand. And now there was one changeover, because I had a friend in Canada that watched it and videotaped a clip for me. And the clip was kind of inconsistent. You see me thrashing and screaming in my bed. And then they pan back to me.
Yeah.
The actual me. And I say, I was laying there calmly in bed. And then there's, you know, they're showing me thrashing around in the reenactment. So they removed that part. At least they wised up on that segment. But then throughout the entire deal, I'm screaming. I mean, Tim, you came and visited me. At any point did I scream and thrash and beg for mercy?
Only when I brought you an Italian beef sandwich and you realized that you couldn't eat it. That was the only time you thrashed about. But no, you never did.
That when they were pulling the catheter out. I think those are the only two times I might have.
Those are the only times I really even heard a peep out of you. That even sounded like whimpering, much less screaming. But yeah. No screaming whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Right, no screaming. I'm fine. Everything's fine. But they represent me as a screaming, raving lunatic. And then there's this kind of weird non sequitur. They start talking, this wasn't Dave Schrader's first time at a hospital. And then they allude to the fact when I went to Louisville, Kentucky, to a famous haunted sanitarium.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
So they can't name the place.
Right, right.
Waverly Hills Sanitarium.
Okay.
They couldn't say it on TV. I guess they couldn't get the permission. But then I tell the story, Tim, which we've shared on the show, how I was walking down the hall with Tina and I see this shadow person and it walks right through me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I turned around. I'm like, what the hell was that? In this, they have me scream and fall back on my back, cowering in fear.
Yeah, you did that a lot. Yeah,
I'm very shaggy like in this episode.
You are. Yeah. I'm surprised they didn't have a scene where Claire turned around and said, "Oh, Dave, eggs and bacon on the table," and you went, "Not eggs and bacon!"
And yeah, I know. I was a little overreactive throughout the entire episode. Yeah. Tim Beckley, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but TV might take some liberties with reality.
Oh, you noticed that? My goodness. Well, I tell you, I have a list of people who, you know, I've interviewed on my show over the years and all, and you mentioned some of these programs and they just cringe. Because they have you in the wrong spot at the wrong time doing the wrong things. And
right.
Like this show on Dr. Hynek, Project Blue Book you know, they claim that it's based on the files of Project Blue Book. But they had one of the one of the Project Blue Book guys pistol whipping somebody on an episode or hitting him with the butt of his rifle or something. I don't think they ever went that far. They'd send the men in black out maybe to do a bit of silencing, but I don't think they were, up on the witnesses.
In these cases, now, Project Blue Book, listen, I just talked to J. Allen Hynek's two sons who are involved in that. As a matter of fact, here's something cool. Both of his sons work behind the scenes in movies. As a matter of fact, the one son is the guy that created the effect in The Matrix of the bullets going in slow motion and Neo bending backwards and avoiding them. He created that. But these two guys are part of it. They unabashedly admit this isn't a reality series. This is like an X-Files, but based on actual cases. So I can forgive the overdramatization of that because you've got to make it entertaining and fun. And listen, in the day of J. Allen Hynek investigating this, there wasn't constant drama. There was just, you know, he would hear these stories. He would report on them. He was, you know, intrigued by it. So they've got to create a family dynamic. They've got to create, you know, living dynamics. So I get all of that. But on a show that's representing a true story, that they couldn't even get the fact that I was in a Minnesota hospital, you know, where I live, they just couldn't get anything correct. I was blown away by that. It was fun. It's entertaining. And as you saw, I got a little emotional during the episode. The guy was good. The director, that Tobin that was talking to me, he knew the right buttons to push. And as we're talking and discussing this case, he really got to the heart. And I guess that did, I got to tell you, cathartically, I felt a lot better after I filmed that episode, because I, for the first time in my life, came to grips with what really bothered me about that scenario. And it was the fact that there were all these spirits in this room begging for help, and I could do nothing to help them. So what we're going to do for our listeners today, Theater of the Mind, Tim and I dip back to a Theater of the Mind from April 17th of 2017, where I tell the actual real story of what happened. And Tim, of course, dramatizes it with the music and sound effects. But this is the actual story that occurred.
I won't be beatboxing throughout this, Dave. No.
But Tim, I did have Billy Dee Williams recut all of your lines.
Oh, good, good.
Yes, I appreciate that. So just keeping in consistency.
Good deal.
And you can hear the crack of a Colt 45 as he's talking to me.
Nice.
But
nice.
That'll be on today's Theater of the Mind. We're going to go to a throwback so that all the listeners that watch that episode, and I'm not going to put down, the series is entertaining and it's fun, Haunted Hospitals. Just understand that through it, there is a narrative of truth, but they do have to overplay some of the drama. And I'm not just saying this because I want people to realize I wasn't screaming and yelling and doing that. I think people have listened to the show enough and have heard me tell these stories enough to know that's not the way I react. But I just thought it was, you know, something I wanted to address because people were needling me left and right about, couldn't you tell them that Tim was white? couldn't you inform them of these things? And I thought, I don't understand why they chose, you know, I mean, it's not like you're hidden, Tim. It's not like I keep you locked in the basement, chained to a board, and there's no photographs of you out there.
I think a 30-second phone call to me, they would have probably pretty much figured it out or could have asked me, you know, I would have told them. Yeah.
Kind of fun stuff. So that's, if you missed it, check out Travel Channel. Make sure to check out the Haunted Hospitals. I'm in episode 3. I think I'm the second story in episode 3. And you can enjoy it. And also, I do have to mention one other thing, Tim. Mm-hmm. So I had experimentally, and Tim Beckley, I think you'll enjoy this, right? I'm reaching that age where I'm looking in my mirror and I'm seeing my face and I'm seeing this old man face look back at me with a gray goatee. And I thought to myself, just for men, I wonder what it would look like. And would it bring back any youthful vigor if I darkened my goatee?
Okay.
So I darkened it with Just for Men and then got a call the next day. Hey, we'd like to fly you out 2 days from now. So I'm doing my best Walter White in this, where suddenly I've got this dark, rich brown goatee, which is not how I look normally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny to me that, you know, that was the one moment. So even I was inconsistent in representing myself, Tim. So how could I have expected them to be any different?
Well,
I do have my best Walter White goatee riding in this episode.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
Yeah, so that's what we got going. Let's get into the topic of today. Tim Beckley, you always join us with some of the most fascinating stories and collections. Timothy Green Beckley, UFO and paranormal pioneer, has had so many careers that he tells us even his girlfriend doesn't know what he does for a living. He has been described as the Hunter Thompson of ufology by the editor of UFO magazine, Nancy Burns. And since his early age of his life, he's pretty much been revolving around all aspects of the strange and supernatural. He has a book out called David Bowie, UFOs, Witchcraft, Cocaine, and Paranoia, the Occult Saga of Wally Elmlark, the Rock and Roll Witch of New York. All right, Tim, let's get into this story and hear a little bit about this. I love all of the different topics, man. You were hitting every hot button. If they're looking in a search bar, you've hit every one of them, from Bowie to cocaine to paranoia and witchcraft. What obviously this has got to take place sometime in the 60s.
Well, let me say, again, with these various careers that I had, one was of promoting local rock and roll bands and writing for entertainment publications of rock and roll newspapers and rock and roll journals and rock and roll magazines. My background has always been in journalism. And at the same time I was doing that, I was promoting these local bands and running the New York School of Occult Arts and Sciences. Now, the New York School of Occult Arts and Sciences was very active between about 1967 to maybe the mid-70s. It was an organization that we founded. We had a 2,400 square foot loft right on Union Square, and we set it up as a classroom. It was one of the first occult centers in the country. We had people coming in and lecturing on everything, including how to use a Ouija board safely. We had seances on at midnight on a Saturday evening, and a lot of our people were connected with the world of rock and roll because, again, that was something that I was involved in. And that all kind of started. Now, when I was a youngster, I guess rock and roll was just coming in. You know, there was Bill Haley in the Comets was Rock Around the Clock. That's generally credited with being the first rock and roll record, although I don't know if that's true or not. But I was fans of like Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard. And when I got old enough to come into New York, I took the bus in and would spend the evenings in Greenwich Village. And there were some artists, some very magnificent artists and guitar players like Jimi Hendrix, who were just cutting their teeth on rock and roll and getting started. And for a couple of bucks, you could sit there from, you know, midnight to 4 o'clock in the morning and just hang out. And I got to know, you know, some of the musicians and some of the managers and road people and so forth. And one of the big promoters in town, I was never a big promoter. I mean, I had little local bands and stuff that we would book. But one of the big promoters in town ran the Academy of Music, which was a 3,600 seater that had been an old opera house. And it was kind of like needed a lot of refurbishing, but it was huge. And in those days, if you paid for tickets, and I never did because I hung out backstage, three acts would cost you about $7 or $8 for the evening. You could see Blue Oyster Cult, Black Sabbath, and Traffic for $8. Can you imagine that? I mean,
unreal.
Today you'd pay $200 just for one band.
Right. Ozzy's doing that tour right now, and it's like $140 a ticket.
Well, now that was the first group that I actually went backstage for. I was walking down 2nd Avenue and 6th Street with admittedly a flask hanging out of my pocket. And I stopped to hear the music coming from the backstage area of the Fillmore East. And there happened to be a gentleman who was a member of a local motorcycle club who was doing security. And somehow we got to talking. And after a brief conversation, usually they'd say, go on your way. But this guy and I seemed to jive. He asked me if I wanted to go in backstage. So I stepped through the barrier to the backstage of the Fillmore East. And basically, I was on stage or pretty darn close to it because that was where they brought the equipment, you know, off the stage in the back. So I always say said I went out that evening. It was 1969, and I never came home. I must have attended maybe 300 or 400 shows all over the East Coast and hung out with some of the bands and met some of the individuals. Now, one of the individuals that I met, there was a young lady by the name of Lila Schulman, who worked for the local concert promoter. She typed up the contracts and ran the office and all. It was a small office. I mean, you don't need a lot of people to run the rock and roll promotion. I mean, you do backstage and all when the event is there, but for an office, you know. Anyway, we got to talking, and it turns out she was interested in the occult, and she was fascinated by the fact that just up the road, a few blocks, I was running the New York School of Occult Arts and Sciences. Well, she told me, she said, there's a lady that hangs out backstage. She writes a column for Melody Maker, which is a big British music magazine at the time, and for Circus. And she's fascinated. She's a witch. She practices white witchcraft, and she's become very good friends with some of the artists that are performing on stage. And so I met this young lady. Her name was Wally Elmark. She ended up speaking at our occult the center on reincarnation and astral projection and candle magic and so forth. And so she introduced me to quite a number of these rock and roll people who were big at the time. And David Bowie was just starting out as Ziggy Stardust. And I met him, and of course I've written about him several times. I talked to him on the telephone, and he was greatly fascinated with UFOs. In fact, as a teenager in England, he had a number of sightings. And was even an associate editor of one of the little UFO zines over there. So I mean, when he did this Ziggy Stardust, I mean he was really into it. And he went through a period of time in his career where he was fascinated by Aleister Crowley and different aspects of the occult. And he got very much deeply into the, I guess, the dark side of all of this. And he admits it. I mean, it's been written up. In fact, his biography, they quote me in it, and they quote my friend Wally. He had gotten very deep into cocaine to the point of being paranoid. And he was staying at a house there in Los Angeles that apparently had a demon in the swimming pool. In fact, so strong was the influence of this demon that they could actually believe that they could see the outline of it in the bottom of the pool. So one of David Bowie's friends was a gal, a poet, and a songwriter by the name of Cherry Vanilla. Very, very attractive red-haired young lady at the time. And in fact, she was involved with Jimi Hendrix's movie that he did called Rainbow Bridge, where he was in Hawaii and they gave a concert on the volcano and they had a UFO sighting. And he goes and sits down and talks to some of the hippies about his belief in the Space Brothers and in life on Mars and so forth and so on. So anyway, Cherry Vanilla got in touch with Wally and said that David Bowie needs some help. Believes that the home that he's staying in is possessed. And also, too, he believed that three witches were trying to steal his semen to create the Antichrist. And so she did a spell for him, and it worked remarkably, I guess. And he later did rid himself of the cocaine addiction, and of course became a very, very solid musician, very one of the most talented individuals I think I've ever met. I mean, I talk about a chameleon. I mean, he could just turn his type of music to whatever was being influential at the time. I just remarkable career, and he passed away well before his time, as far as I'm concerned. And of course, this period of the late 60s into the mid 70s was ripe with both rock and roll, of course, and the occult. I mean, there was a great fascination among teenagers and college students. And I guess there still is today, but it was a field that was just kind of rising in popularity. There was like a Sybil Leek, the British witch. There was, of course, Anton LaVey, who practiced Satanism, or his brand of Satanism. And the subject was getting a lot of attention. In fact, I think even Time magazine had put some pentagram or talisman on the cover. It was something that a lot of people, including celebrities and especially younger musicians, were into. And so since this is what I was into, the music and the occult, I got to meet and fraternize with quite a few of them.
What was it like? I mean, to hear these stories, and obviously, I mean, David Bowie rose to meteoric heights.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, and to realize he not only had kind of a belief in this, but firmly rooted. Do you think, in all honesty, Tim, how much of this was drug fuel, paranoia, and how much do you believe was truly strange supernatural occurrences?
Oh my goodness, that's kind of hard to pinpoint. You know, well, his wife at the time, David was married twice. His wife at the time, she seemed to believe that there was some spirits that were at play. That was Angela Bowie. Spirits were at play in this property out there in California. And I know that he was genuinely interested in the subject. Now, the few times that I talked to him on the phone, I would be staying at Wally's house, apartment here in Manhattan off of Central Park. And he was not stoned when he talked to me. I might have been more stoned than he was in those days. But he seemed, he was asking me questions about the subject, and wanted to know something about, I guess he was trying to do some, was involved in the tree of life. In fact, there's a photograph in the book, the David Bowie UFOs, Witchcraft, Cocaine, and Paranoia, where he's sitting on the floor doing a diagram of the Kabbalah, you know, the tree of life. And he was interested in a lot of aspects like that, and also Aleister Crowley, but not from a sinister point of view, but from, you know, the mere magical point of view. So I don't know. He was genuinely interested in the subject. His paranoia, I can't say that I felt that first hand. I mean, when I'd see these people in public, we were all kind of a lot of drinking going on backstage. I would say to excess in some cases. And a fair amount of hallucinogens, which I was never into, frankly, and so-called magical powder that can twist your head around from time to time.
Yeah, the devil's dandruff, right?
Is that what it's called? Okay.
Oh, look at you all. Oh, is that what it's called? Is that what the kids are referring to it as?
I didn't know that. Well, see, I'm a little behind in the times, I guess, but I'm still stuck in the 60s. I do remember one time Alice Cooper was just breaking out and playing here in New York. I swapped him two joints for two tickets to his show. I think it was a town hall at the time, and probably went to more backstage concerts with Kiss than any other band, although outside of Ace Frehley, they didn't seem to be into the subject really. You know, Ace had a couple of UFO sightings, including and this I never talked to him about because I hadn't heard about it until more recently. Supposedly something landed on his home property, backyard, whatever you want to call it, in Westchester. But I never really did get the inside story on that. I do know that he told me he was flying, I guess, from California to Chicago or something one time, and this orange fireball seemed to be pacing the airplane, you know. But our big contact, of course, Wally had gone to England. And like I say, she had befriended a lot of these rock and rollers. She was just totally mesmerized by Mark Bolan, you know, from T-Rex, Bang a Gong, Get It On.
Right.
And so forth. And she believed that he was the reincarnation of Merlin, the magician from King Arthur's court. And she never did spend as much time with him as she wanted to. And, you know, but he did write a lot of very poetic songs that were full of stories of dragons and witches and great enchantment. And I talked to his producer, Tony Visconti, about this, and he denied that Mark had any interest in this at all, which I thought was kind of strange because you could read it in the in the music that he was writing. But Wally was totally mesmerized by him. And of course, he died at a very early age as well. He was driving in a car and I guess speeding or what have you, and ran into a tree and killed him almost instantly and cut his life short. Now, Wally believes that a lot of these rock and rollers were coming here and reincarnating into earthly bodies. I guess the one she favored the most in that aspect would be Jimi Hendrix. Now, I did see Jimi Hendrix perform a couple of times. In fact, before he was, famous, actually, he used to play some of the clubs like the Cafe Juan in Greenwich Village. And he had an immense interest in UFOs. And of course, he wrote about this in some of his songs. And as I mentioned, he did a video. It's called, I think, Up Rainbow Hill, where after the concert in Maui, he sits around and talks to some of the young hippies there about his belief in the Space Brothers and life on Mars and so forth. Now, I was good friends I met Jimmy once backstage, but just in passing. I was good friends with Curtis Knight. Now, Curtis Knight was the original bass player in a band called the Squires that Hendrix played guitar in. This was before he became famous. And they traveled around mainly the East Coast doing gigs and stuff like that. And according to Curtis, who's since passed away, they were up in Woodstock, New York, and it had nothing to do with the festival. This was before then. And it was they were caught coming back to Manhattan during a very, very bad snowstorm. And the van, you know, of course, in those days, if you were an up-and-coming artist, you lugged your own equipment around. You didn't have roadies and stuff like that. So they, you know, they had a van with the three or four members of the group in there and all their equipment tucked away in the back and rolling down the highway on the way back to Manhattan. And they were caught in a very, very bad snowstorm. In fact, they were stuck at the side of the road. And at one point, they thought that they were going to freeze to death. They were very concerned, you know, if they kept the radiator on, that they might get carbon monoxide poisoning. But if they shut the radiator off in the car, the heater off in the car, they might freeze to death. Well, at some point, according to Curtis Knight, this rocket-shaped object landed not too far from their van. A ramp of some sort lowered, and out walked this. Well, from the way he described it, it was a cross between an angel and Mothman. And this being walked down the ramp, circled the van that Jimi Hendrix and his group, the Squires, were in, and the snow around the van melted. And they were able to start the vehicle and get back to New York without any further mishap.
No,
now, you would say, well, that sounds like a fanciful story. And I would say, yes. And now Curtis was full of stories, some of which I can't even repeat on the air. They involve rock and roll and groupies and so forth. He was obviously, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest guitarist of all time. And the one time that I did happen to get high on psychedelics, he was performing. And let me tell you that the notes came out in color out of the speakers and just like marched up towards me. I have never seen or experienced anything like that in my life. And, you know, I never did hallucinogens after that. It was not quite my style, although it was the latter part of the 60s and the 70s and everybody was doing them, and certainly quite a few of our friends. It was never quite my style, and you know, I figured, guys, I saw Jimi Hendrix and I experienced this. What the hell else would you want to have happen to you on LSD or mescaline? And that was quite a performance that he gave. And on the same bill was Dr. John the Night Tripper. And there's a photo of him in the book about Wally. He used to come to our occult center. Now, he was from New Orleans, and he was into the, they call it gris-gris magic, which is kind of like neither black or white magic. It's kind of a gray area. You know, you do magic for whatever purpose you have in mind. Sometimes it could be a little bit on the darker or negative side, but he had his oils and his candles, and he came down once to the occult center and set up shop right there. And we've got some photos of him in the book. But he used to come out on stage and do a whole ritual. He had a sash by his side, and he would sprinkle glitter onto the audience. So you can imagine, after seeing Jimi Hendrix, the notes flying out of the speakers, and then Dr. John with the gree-gree and the glitter going all everybody over everybody in the front row. I love rock and roll, and it just and I just, you know, I wanted to get involved with it as much as I possibly could. but it was always a secondary thing, because I was involved in, and like I said, doing the occult center
thing. It might be secondary, but yeah. What a time to have experimented. If ever there was going to be a time to experiment, I couldn't even begin to imagine. I mean, Tim and I are huge fans of Jimi Hendrix.
I bow down. You know, I think about this, and I almost sit here with tears in my eyes. How can you bring back those nights? And sometimes the nights turned into the next day, because, you know, now when you play a big auditorium or venue, the union requires that you close up and get out of there by 11 o'clock, or what they charge a time and a half or something. Well, Howard Stein, who was the promoter here in New York, and the Academy of Music, he rented the hall for the whole evening. So you had an 8 o'clock show, and you had an 11:30 show. Well, the Grateful Dead or the Allman Brothers, I was more into them. They would come on and do their, like, you know, the 30-minute jams. And sometimes I would leave that theater. The sun was coming up. And then after the sun came up, we would find some all place to go and hang out. You know, I mean, we had friends that lived in the neighborhood, or there were after hours clubs that if you knew the right knock on the door, you could go in and they'd be playing music in there. So it was quite a time. And I never liked folk music. I didn't. I thought Bob Dylan sucked. I'm sorry. I was not fans of Peter, Paul and Mary or their Puff the Magic Dragon. I must say I was into, I guess what would you could call it, hard rock, but it really wasn't. It was just would be considered classic rock and roll. And then I got into glam and glitter. I'm actually on the Edgar Winter Frankenstein album. Now, if you're familiar with that album, and certainly, I guess most people are, it sold millions and millions of copies. Poor Edgar is seen with the rhinestones and makeup and glitter on. He hated that. I mean, he hated that image. I don't think the music that he performed, of course, Frankenstein, I mean, it goes on for what, about 8 minutes or something. I'm on that album. It's a song called "We All Had a Really Good Time." Now, I don't sing. I don't play an instrument. But what they did is the record company rented the recording studio, or maybe they owned it, for the evening. Got a bunch of us in there, including Bette Midler, the Chambers Brothers, and Rick Derringer. Threw in a couple of bottles of vodka and whiskey and turned on the microphones. And we all had a good time. And so I'm clinking the ashtray with my keys, and other people are hooting and hollering. And that's the background to that song on the Frankenstein album, "We All Had a Really Good Time."
Very cool.
And so I could say I'm on a platinum record.
Hey, not a bad pedigree.
Not bad at all. And of course, now we were friends.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have to continue with your stories. We've got a lot more to talk about. But before we do that, 60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? You can get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a true cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or at home. Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions, and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from local TrueCar certified dealers. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in, and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask all the questions you have and get the answers you need, so there's never any surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. And as promised, here is a throwback theater of the mind, the real haunted hospital story of Darkness Dave, here on Theater of the Mind.
My room was filled with visitors and medical staff alike, all stopping by to check on my recovery after an emergency gallbladder removal. The pain was unreal. and I was connected to a wonderful pain reduction system, the morphine drip, and with a push of a button could control my own pain pleasure principle and control it, or perhaps over control it, I did. That's when I started to notice a very strange situation unfolding in my hospital room. I realized that aside from the busyness of visitors and nurses checking on me, I had, unbeknownst to the others in my room, a large gathering of shadowy figures watching over me, patiently waiting for those moments when I could see them and they could attempt communication. Now, I know what you're all thinking. Drugs, hallucinations, wild imagination. And I cannot for certain disagree. However, I know that these moments, when I could see them, are as burned in my memory more clearly than the conversations and interactions I was having with the living, breathing visitors in my room. Never before had I experienced such a strange and surreal situation. While my eyes were open, I could see, hear, and communicate with all of my fleshy, warm-blooded friends. But when my eyes closed, I could still see every detail of my room, with the exception of the actual people in it. I could still hear them and interact, but they were no longer in my visual spectrum. I could hear the pinging of machines, the monitor alarms sounding throughout the hospital, the overhead page system seeking doctors to their stations. My room was filled with ashen-faced, silent beings, many of whom stood there watching me. Only a few would move. And then there was the woman, a wild-haired, elderly woman, who would float there in front of my face. Her hair seemed to be blowing by some unseen force, her eyes piercing and her face filled with lines and anguish. She would stare deeply into my eyes, mouthing words in a silent scream that I could not hear. Insisting that I pay attention to her, she grew angrier and more persistent as my stay continued, which also led me to believe that this was more, so much more than just a drug-filled hallucination. My conscious, or perhaps my subconscious, were wide open to another level of existence. And they knew it. They could sense that I was straddling two realms, and they were opportunists, making sure that I would see and remember everything. Now, one particular day, Tim came to visit. He brought me some snacks and some things to read. It was nice to see him, and we shared some small talk, just chit-chat, mostly about my need for attention and faking illness in order to take time off from work, and then we'd laugh.
You better take care of yourself and get your ass back on the air,
he insisted with a smile. The dreamy effects of morphine drip were causing my eyelids to grow heavier and slam shut from time to time. Tim would let out with a laugh and poke fun.
Morphine, it's a hell of a drug, huh, D?
We would laugh, and I would fight to keep my eyes open. We spoke about my son's wedding coming up that weekend and how Tim was willing to give me a piggyback ride to the nuptials if I needed one. I replied with a smirk and a snicker, then my eyes closed, and I could see my room again, devoid of Tim or my girlfriend at the time or my son. My head slowly pivoted to the opposite direction of my living friends and focused to the corner of the room where my less lively roommates had congregated. One moved forward and pointed at me, his long finger wagging, his mouth obviously moving in an unheard conversation. All I could hear was this creepy hissing noise from his mouth. While the others spoke in hushed whispers, I couldn't make out, but they seemed to fill the room. I spoke out. I'm sorry, I just can't hear you. I wish I could. I see your mouths move, but I can't hear a word. Then I heard Tim's concerned voice question me.
Hey, D, I'm over here. Who are you talking to?
I informed him. There were a lot of people here wanting to be heard. There was a bit of a pregnant pause, and I heard his voice cut through my surreal experience. Only this time, all the spirits in my room turned to face him as well.
Hey, buddy, there's no one over there,
he assured me.
We're all over here on this side of the room.
I laughed and said, good thing, because it's pretty crowded over here and I can see them only when I close my eyes. There was another hesitation. Then Tim retorted,
hey Dave, are you kidding around? Is everything okay, brother?
My head turned to the sound of his voice. It was weird. I could hear him so clearly, but visually could not see him. Yet, in the other part of my room, I could see the throngs of creepy roommates I had amassed, but I could not hear them. My eyes popped open,
and I looked into the face of my worrisome friend. It's all good, Tim. Morphine is a hell of a drug. And with that, our conversation came to an abrupt end. My eyes dreamily closed, and I heard him tell my girlfriend,
I'm gonna head out. Let me know how he's doing. That was really weird.
The days after I was released, I racked my brain, trying to understand, and often vacillating between belief and disbelief of what I had witnessed. I tried so hard to convince myself that everything I saw and experienced was the machinations of a drug-induced haze. But I could remember it all. So clear, so vivid, and that stuck with me. That sent me down a rabbit hole that I have yet to pull myself out of, trying to understand or comprehend what is going on around us, unseen at all times. Are we just that close to another reality or dimension? Do the dead really surround us? Then my heart sank as I thought about a room filled with ashen, washed-out ghosts, trapped, caught between this world and the next, and filling the rooms and halls of hospitals, asylums, and institutions around the world. How many millions, or perhaps hundreds of millions of spirits must still walk these halls? What I found most disturbing was why they were still here, walking among us, especially in places like that. I mean, I would hope in the end, if I stay, I'll be bouncing between visiting my kids, scaring some investigators at an old asylum, or popping in and out of the nearest Hooters. Hey, what? I'm only human. Why do spirits choose to stay or be stuck in these circumstances? My only solace came from a fellow investigator and researcher that shed some light on what may come next and why those that stay here are still here. It was a packed bar filled with muted conversations lost over the sound of 80s music playing through the speakers when my dear friend Misty Bay looked deeply into my eyes and said,
when we all die, all that we are, the good, the promise, the light, will go on and complete its journey, wherever that may be. And that which is left behind, the anger, the resentment, jealousy, pettiness, the base, the animal part of all of us. That's why communication is often short, limited to bangs and flickering lights and an occasional get out, and why most communication is so basic. It leaves behind the animal instinct, pack mentality of sticking with others like itself in an environment that it's familiar with, until at some point that energy fades and finally goes out like a match in the breeze.
I looked at her and questioned, well, then what happens to the light of us, the best of us? Without missing a beat, she lifted the beer bottle to her lips, took another long pull, and said,
now that is the real question, isn't it?
With that, we sat in silence, enjoying our libations and reflecting on the imaginings of what lies beyond. So try to comfort yourself with that thought as you hear tales of lost spirits, the communication, and the reality that seems to be pushing itself into our realm. Take a moment to realize that, much like Jacob Marley warned as he rattled his chains in dire warning to Ebenezer Scrooge in Dickens' A Christmas Carol,
the chains we forge in this life, we must carry on to the next, Ebenezer.
Be kind, shorten those chains, and make life right while you have the chance, instead of leaving a dark and tortured version of yourself behind, bound to this earth by all the negativity we create for ourselves and bask in daily. Maybe, just maybe, the longer you allow the negative in and to surround you, the longer that part of you will stay behind until it fades. So welcome to a world of possibilities, of nightmares and hope. Welcome to the reality that is the supernatural.
Beyond the Darkness listeners, if you like this show, then you're going to love the Laura Ingraham Show podcast on Podcast One. Join Laura as she takes on politics and pop culture with some hard-hitting guests and takes your calls. Download the Laura Ingraham Show podcast every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Tonight, we're talking with Timothy Green Beckley, his book, David Bowie, UFOs, Witchcraft, Cocaine, and Paranoia, the occult saga of Wally Elmlark, the rock and roll witch of New York. You talked about the fact that she squared off against whatever it was that was interfering in Bowie's life. I mean, it sounds like that almost kind of set him on a new path and a new life. She seems to have almost saved him. I mean, is that a fair assumption?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, she passed away at her own hands. She took an overdose of barbiturates. That would have been, they were prescription drugs, but she took too many of them, I guess. She passed away, I think, in 1980 or 1981. Maybe about 10 years ago when I started writing all this up, and I did, some interviews, on this, I got, an email from somebody, and I won't tell you what name he is, but I knew right away it was David Bowie, because first of all, I knew most of her friends, her boyfriends, the people that were members of her group. In fact, in this book, we found about a half, even though maybe four decades have passed, we found about a half a dozen people who knew her very well, who wrote remarkable things about her, because she did have this very charismatic posture. She, you know, she wasn't goth in those days. It really wasn't goth, but she did dress usually all in black. She had a green streak in her hair, and she wore a lot of silver, because she believed that silver was a way that you could resonate with the goddess Diana in the witchcraft religion of Wicca that she followed.
She looks like she was channeling Grace Slick pretty tight as well.
Yes, I think you could say that. But she had a style. She had a style and a charisma, and people still talk about her to this very day. I mean, I'm always when I started putting this book together, and I had been meaning to do it for a while, because she didn't quite influence my life maybe in the same way that she did some of these rock and roll artists. But she was a charming person, and she had a very unique personality. She was well ahead of her time. I guess that's what you would say, you know. And so I did a lot of research on some of these artists. She also was good friends with Freddie Prinze Sr., who committed the suicide. I think he shot himself. Well, he was fascinated and actually possessed by the spirit of Lenny Bruce, you know, who was the satirical, I guess you would call him that, very controversial a comic who used a lot of vulgarity and I believe was arrested and thrown in jail several times for using four-letter words. I mean, really.
Well, you throw that out as a matter of fact. How you believe, or who believed, that he was possessed by Freddie Prinze Sr.?
Freddie Prinze believed that. In fact, my associate here, Carol Rodriguez, who does a lot of our artwork, and she's in the book, actually heard a tape that Wally had made of Freddie Prinze Sr. while he was possessed by Lenny Bruce. And other people have told me.
Really?
That, yeah. I mean, this is I was going to say it's a little known fact, but I don't think it's ever been mentioned before this book was published. And it's only been out a couple of weeks. But she knew not only musicians, but she knew people in what I guess you would consider the counterculture. She was very good friends with Juan Bodie, who did kind of adult underground comics. And he later committed the suicide, but by accident. And he had a fondness for her. And they were going to go on some sort of tour together. He was going to do his cartoons, like projected on a screen while he did the audio, and then she would talk about witchcraft. Now, Wally, outside of lecturing for our New York School of Occult Arts and Sciences, she also was with a very big a speakers bureau in Boston. I think it was the American Program Bureau, and they booked you know, everybody, the vice president and people like that. And she went around to various colleges, speaking about Wicca and witchcraft when nobody else was doing this. And she had such a charming personality that she could get it across. And there was not a negative bone in her body as far as the witchcraft and all went. She was very, very positive, you know, with all of this. She performed her candle magic. She also worked with gemstones. We go into some detail. I had some notes that I had taken down that she had written during this period. So she goes into some of the philosophy that, you know, she believed in as far as the Wicca religion goes. You know, there's certain days of the year that are, you know, considered high holy Sabbaths as far as the witches go. But you've had all these, you've had similar people on your show. But sure. she was very unique in that she worked with a lot of these musicians and artists. Now, she had actually gone to England with Robert Fripp, who is the guitarist for King Crimson. And Robert and I had a pretty close friendship back in the early 70s. In fact, we had a skywatch on the roof of Wally's apartment building just off of Central Park. There was a UFO landing that had taken place in a park in New Jersey. And a gentleman had been driving through the park, I guess, late at night on his way home, coming back from Manhattan. And he had seen this object on some sort of tripod landing gear sitting there in the park. And several small beings, kind of dwarf-like, were in the park digging up soil. Or something. They seemed to have some shovels and some bucket-like device, and then they went back into the craft, and the craft took off. Now, people thought, well, he was a little bit wacketing hoy, to quote a phrase that Long John Neville used to use, but there were other witnesses to this, and it was, now, talk about synchronicities. This particular landing or close encounter took place directly across from the Stonehenge apartment building. So maybe the aliens maybe the aliens were a little bit confused, and they thought that they were in the UK or something. But apparently, when the object took off, there were some pellets or rocks, you know, small rocks, pebbles. That's the word I'm looking for, that were thrown up against the glass of the front door or the window there at the Stonehenge apartment building. And it made a, you know, little pit marks in there, you know, how glass, when it doesn't break, but kind of you can tell it was hit by something. And so we tried to have a skywatch there in the park, but we were overrun by the crazies and the fringe groups. Guys were like dressed up in tinfoil running through the park with sparklers on, and they were selling, you know, cigar-shaped hot dogs. It was a real fiasco. But it made the Newark Star Ledger. You know, we always had tried to have a little fun with this, you know, and take it seriously at the same time. It's kind of just like Hollywood that we were talking about, right? And anyway, so we all got tossed out of the park. Finally, we ended up, I think, a day later on the roof of Wally's apartment building. And Robert Fripp was there, and Ruth Warwick was a good friend of ours. She was on the soap opera All My Children. And we all held hands, and Wally sent out a message to the space people to come down and show themselves. But I don't think that they actually did. But we have photographs in the book of all of us standing around in a circle, including Robert Fripp, looking up at the sky in binoculars. Anyway, he took her to England. And they were going to record a spoken record with Mark Bolan and David Bowie and Brian Eno. And they did record it, but the tape got lost or destroyed or something. And it was, according to Robert Fripp, it was not commercially viable. and it never got released. But we've got that entire episode in the book there for fans of Robert Fripp and King Crimson, and he certainly plays a rather unique brand of music. I wouldn't call it hard.
I was just going to say, was there a pretty deep thread through many of the different careers of musicians when it came to the occult and music?
Yeah, well, a lot of them even included it in their music. Now, Robert Fripp also produced Hall & Oates. There was only one that he did. Oates, I believe it was, the blonde-haired guy. I always get this wrong. And some of the music, I've read some of the lyrics. He was, well, both of them were deeply into Gurdjieff and Ouspensky. Is that the right? Philosophy. And I guess to some degree, Madame Blavatsky. But yeah, they really did read up on this, type of literature, because, like I say, some of them came down to the occult center and walked off with a couple of books, and some of them even hung out and did the Ouija board. I had a gal who was a professional wrestler by the name of Vivian St. John. She was the women's world champion. Well, of course, everybody's a champion when you're with the WWE. I mean, so at one point in your career, you're going to be the world champ. Anyway, she wrestled in Madison Square Garden, and she was part of the fabulous Moolah entourage. And she used to, I knew her very well. In fact, we did a lot of traveling and just hanging out together, you know. And she would show up at the occult center whenever she was in town. And she was very handy with the Ouija board. Now, I always found the Ouija board, to be honest with you, a little bit boring, because most of the time you sit there with a lot of talcum powder all over your lap, you know, for the planchette to move. And you don't get much in the way of messages coming through. I mean, a lot of times you get gibberish or information that's not very accurate. I would rather go into a semi-trance myself and come up with something, because a good Ouija board session could last a couple of hours, and I'm a little antsy in the pantsy to just sit around for that long period of time. Anyway, Suzanne, that was a real name, Lady Suzanne, Vivian, as she's was known by. Came over one evening, and her estranged husband, I mean, they were still friends, but they weren't married any longer, had disappeared. He promised that he was going to show up at the apartment or the occult center over the weekend, and he never called. Now, of course, we didn't have cell phones in all those days, but still he could have, you know, dropped a dime, as they say. And we never heard from him. So she insisted on getting out the Ouija board, and we put the Ouija board down and put the talcum powder on it, and we sat around asking it questions. Now, it was a fairly long session. In fact, it had a little bit to do with the rock and roll. I've written it up, and all the details don't stick into my mind, because we're talking about, 35, 40 years ago. So my memory is getting a little bit soft these days on some of the details. But basically, the part about her husband, the spirit came through and said that Stanley was okay, but that he had gotten in a accident outside the town of Tuxedo, New York, which was, I mean, maybe about 70 miles from here. Well, 2 or 3 days later, Stanley showed up, rang the doorbell, and there he was. His had a couple of bandages on his forehead. So we wanted to know, Stanley, what happened to you? Well, it was pretty much like the Ouija board had stated. He was in an accident. He had stopped or slowed down at the side of the road to look at somebody's car that was on fire. I think, is that called rubbernecking or something like that? And I don't know, somebody collided with him in back, you know, and threw him up against the windshield, and he ended up going to the hospital. Nothing major. I think he stayed in overnight. But the Ouija board did speak the truth. Now, when we asked the Ouija board who was talking to us, It gave us a name, and I happened to mention this later on in the day to this gal, Lila Schulman, who worked for the local rock and roll promoter. You know, she typed up all the contracts and things like that. And it turned out that when I mentioned the name of the spirit that came through, she said, you know, that was a friend of mine who had gotten killed, I think she said, in an automobile accident maybe some months before. And it turned out that this person had lived like a half a block away from where my apartment was at the time where we were doing the Ouija board. And there were some other things that came through about UFOs and things about a landing in Albany. But it turned out it wasn't Albany, New York. It was Albany, Georgia or something. Everything turned out to be pretty much accurate with the Ouija board reading. And I would say that's the only really, really accurate one that I can think of. Now, my mother used to dabble with the Ouija board, and she claimed that she got to the point where entities would actually appear in the next room while she would be asking the Ouija board questions.
That's wild. Would she physically see them or just hear them in the other room?
No. See them. Yeah. Actually see. I don't know if she heard them. She would see them. Yeah. Again, I had already moved out of the house. You know, I was on my own at that time, but she would always fill me in on the details. You know, I guess I kind of grew up with this stuff, you know, but in those days we didn't equate UFOs to the paranormal. UFOs, we were told, had to be, spaceships or starships or something. And, then years later, we realized that there's more of a connection between the two than we often realized. And maybe most of these things are not coming here from some other planet. They're probably part of some parallel universe or other dimension. Or maybe we're all part of some computer, a program. That's what Philip K. Dick believed. And after reading some of his literature and writing down my own synchronicities, I think we're somebody's computer program. And a lot of this paranormal phenomenon, ghostly phenomenon, UFOs that we witness and experience is part of this.
The whole concept of rock and roll and music and the power of the supernatural. And, you know, it's interesting to me that when you reflect back, and although, yes, you were on hallucinogenics, could physically see, I know, but what I was going to say is could see the music, you could see the notes, you could see this. It's interesting to the perception aspect. And I wonder if some of these musicians in the heat of it, when they're doing this and channeling this entertaining aspect of their soul, if they're seeing this in the same way. You know, I mean, when you read about Beethoven and the fact that the guy's deaf, but he could still feel the music and knew what it would sound like, even though his hearing was so deeply impaired, there seemed to be an otherworldly presence in his life and in Mozart's life. So many of the musicians we know, even up to kid Johnny Lang, now known as just Johnny Lang. But, you know, it was like there was something that superseded them as a human and made them supernatural entities. And the music seems to be the connective tissue in many of these stories.
Well, I think I'm sure you've had Grant Cameron on your show, and he was never much of a rock and roller, but somehow he got involved in this aspect of it, and he started questioning a lot of these musicians, and a lot of them would admit that the music wasn't their words or their thoughts or ideas, that it was coming from somewhere else. Now, the Chambers Brothers, they did the song "Time Has Come Today." That was their one big hit. I think they had a 12-minute version. They were mainly gospel singers, but they did a couple of rock and roll songs. And I remember it was Joe Chambers and one of his other brothers, and they were in two different parts of their home in Connecticut, and they ended up writing the same song at pretty much the same time. But even though they were separated by, a different floor or something like that, they didn't realize what somebody was reading in the writing in the library and the other person was writing in the living room or something, you know.
It certainly makes you question when inspiration strikes. For those that are smart enough to see it and move forward on it, that proves that there is no new idea. It's just who acts on the idea first, who gets this, because I can't tell you how many times I hear somebody go, that was my idea. How did they? And I'm like, well, no, it's not your idea. If you did not, it was an idea given to you, but you didn't accept it. You didn't move on it. Somebody else did. And I love the case, Tim, where it's always like, well, I don't have that kind of money. And then you read the story of the person that did make that jump. And most times they were at their worst point in their life, financially, morally, spiritually. They were almost bankrupt, but they made a choice. They found a way to move forward. They borrowed the money. They borrowed the time, whatever it was. And now they're a billionaire. And it really kind of gives you that concept again, right? This music exists. This is out there eternal, and it's just ours. We have to pick it and take it. Have you seen the commercials? There's a brand new movie coming out. I'm really excited to see, called Yesterday.
Not familiar with it, no.
It's kind of cool. It takes place right here, right? You know, our version of the universe, and the power shuts down for a second. When it reboots in this guy's house, he's somehow shifted into a parallel universe where the Beatles never existed, but he still remembers all the music, and he becomes this multi, you know, faceted musician, because he's singing the Beatles songs that version of Earth never heard. It looks really fascinating. But again, there's that concept of, if he would have realized that and just sat quietly and idly by, not sharing that with the rest of the world, but he took the step forward because he knew. And that's what some of the greatest artists in the world do, is listen, it was there for the taking. It wasn't mine. It existed. I just picked it and took it out to the world to share it with everyone.
Well, I think Steve Spielberg pretty much bought out the influence of music in Close Encounters, of course, when they play a tune and the mothership responds to it. And speaking of the Beatles, of course, John Lennon had a very interesting UFO sighting, and he was with his, I guess he was at that point separated from Yoko Ono, and was living with May Pang, who has an interest in all of these subjects. I've been on the TV and the radio with her a couple of times, and they were out on the balcony. He was living in the Dakota right there off of Central Park, and they had just ordered a pizza and were standing around naked. and here comes this UFO with its flashing lights, and pretty close to where they were on the balcony at the time. And he actually went to the extent of calling up the Daily News and reporting what he had seen. And there's even an illustration on one of his albums, and I usually get this wrong, but I think it's Walls and Bridges, maybe, that it shows this some UFO, the UFO that he saw. And May Pang confirmed this, to me. In fact, I think there's an actual interview with John Lennon out there somewhere on YouTube where he talks about this, you know. And he was good friends with Uri Geller. Uri, of course, was very into the celebrity trip when he first came over to New York. In fact, I took him up to meet Muhammad Ali. Ali was the king of celebrity UFO sighters. I think he claimed something like 21 UFO sightings. When I first met Ali, he had just had a sighting of two objects that were hanging behind one of the skyscrapers in New York, like giant light bulbs. And so he actually was jogging through Central Park. I had to keep pace with him. I guess he was training for one of his fights. His manager was there, Angela Dundee and all. And then we went over to his house a month or so later. And I think he lived in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And he had all these classic cars in the driveway. What a house he had, you know. House were pretty well set up at the time. And he had a great interest in UFOs. He told us all about his sightings. And one of the best ones that he had was he was driving back to his camp that they had in Deer Park, I think, Pennsylvania, with training camp. And they saw this large cigar-shaped craft pass over the limousine on the turnpike. And that impressed them a lot. So we brought Uri Geller up there, but the two of them didn't seem to vibe all that well, because Ali considered himself a magician, an amateur musician, a magician of some sort. And he had been told, I guess, by Johnny Carson and maybe the Amazing Randy that, you know, all this type of stuff, prestidigitation and bending the spoons and all of that stuff was just trickery. So he didn't seem that interested. But there were several people in Ali's camp that were, including his wife, Belinda. Now, we were off to the side. Ali was in some other part of the camp. Giving a lecture of his own. He used to stand up on a rock, ring a bell, and all his followers and visitors, whoever was there, would come in and listen to his talk of the day. But anyway, we were off to the side with his wife, Belinda, and she had on a ring of some sort. And she wanted to see Ali, wanted to see Yuri do, you know, something spectacular. So Yuri took his hand and put it over her finger where she had the ring on, and he said, you know, like, concentrate, tell me if you feel anything different. And after a few a minute or so, she says, I feel my hand getting warm. Well, he finally removed his hand from her hand, and the stone inside the setting had disappeared. Well, he didn't have a chisel, he didn't have any jewelry implements with him to dig it out. I mean, I watched from a foot away. All he did was put his hand over hers, and the stone had disappeared. And there was another fellow there who was Ali's sparring partner, who had on a pretty heavy Christian medallion, but it wasn't a flimsy one. It was a pretty heavy one. And Yuri took his thumb and pressed it into the back of the metal, and the metal had an imprint on it from where his finger was. So I don't know. I mean, I don't see that as being a magic trick like Johnny Carson,
right?
Or Randy.
Well, I think there was a different version of the. The Amazing Randy contacted Johnny and said, "Replace Yuri's spoons with these spoons," and Yuri was unable to do it. We do have to take a quick break. Sunday Scaries describes that feeling of impending doom of the upcoming work week. When you're dreading your responsibilities and questioning your entire existence, did you spend too much money over the weekend? Send a text message you kind of regret? Maybe you drank too much, procrastinate at work or homework assignment, or maybe you just forgot to pay your bills. Sunday Scaries makes these daily anxieties not so scary and allows for you to enjoy the now. Sunday Scaries gummies provide a calm, clean sense of relief and mild euphoria. Sunday Scaries are a healthy, non-habit forming remedy for dealing with life's little nuances. These CBD gummies are custom formulated with a 10 milligram blend of broad spectrum and isolate CBD, as well as vitamins B12 and D3 for mood boosters. They're made with natural ingredients and are all gluten-free, dairy-free, yeast, egg, soy, and peanut-free. Sunday Scaries can be ordered online from their website, sundayscaries.com, sundayscaries.com, and ship directly to your front door. There are also subscription packages for recurring monthly orders at a discounted rate. And right now, our listeners can buy Sunday Scaries with a 10% discount and free shipping at sundayscaries.com using promo code Darkness. That's sundayscaries.com, sundayscaries.com, and use promo code Darkness. That's DARKNESS. Sunday Scaries gummies contain zero THC, which means they're non-psychoactive and will not get you high, but you will get that relief from the anxiety. I love them. I use them. Tim loves them. He uses them. Here's a chance for you to get back some of that euphoria, some of that happiness, and take away so much of that negativity and anxiety that weighs us down. Go do it now, sundayscaries.com, and get that 10% discount and free shipping by using promo code Darkness. We're back with Tim Beckley and talking about a myriad of different topics. Tim Dennis, I know you had a question and wanted to follow up a little bit on David Bowie. Please go ahead.
Yeah, it's kind of burning at me here, Tim, as we were talking a little bit about his period in the 70s, which I think a lot of the media, when it came to Bowie, kind of took that as his cocaine-fueled occult craziness. I'll put that in quotes, okay? That's not attributed to me, but the media. kind of pigeonholed that as his, well, that was a cocaine-fueled dalliance, and they left it at that. I want to get your impressions on this. You know, when before Bowie died, as he was dying, he recorded the Black Star album, and then posthumously it was released. I want your impressions, and I'm not going to color your impressions at all here. Have you listened to the Black Star album? Have you seen the videos? And what is your impression of what Black Star was when he released it?
Well, you know, I'll be darn honest with you. I was a fan of David Bowie during the Ziggy Star. That's when I met him. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was Ziggy Stardust, and he was always Ziggy Stardust to me and to Wally. Now, I do have a few insights, and I don't know how much I should say about this, but someone who is a good friend of mine has taught. Maybe I shouldn't get into it, but. I have some connections into this, but I did lose the contact with him in the later years. The music just wasn't some. I know that the Dark Star that you're talking about supposedly might even refer to something to do with Planet X, mm-hmm. but I can't say that I've listened to the music that close enough to really identify it as such.
I kind of get.
I'm more of the hardcore rock and roller type, and his music got a little bit out of that category, I guess. Well, like I say, he was like a chameleon. He had many, many different personalities. Now, the demon in the swimming pool and the outline of the demon in the pool or whatever, that might have been during the height of his drug fueled the paranoia. I know that it was said that he would just sit around like with piles of books and cocaine on the coffee table. His favorite author was Dionne Fortune, who wrote, I believe her best-selling book would have been Moonchild.
Mm-hmm.
And she was quite a prolific author at the time. And in fact, I believe she started the Inner Light Society, and mine is Inner Light Publications. Never knew that there was a connection between the two. But the other incidents with his interest in UFOs and all of that, and his sighting as a teenager, and his music writing, I don't think you could be that highly fueled on drugs and accomplish. Maybe you can get out on stage and smash a few guitars like the Who did and all. But I don't think that you could sit there and be that, creative. So, no, I think he had a genuinely sincere interest in all of these things. I mean, the Tree of Life and the Kabbalah is certainly a lot more, complicated than I've ever actually gotten involved in it. So, yeah, I would say that he was, and from speaking to him on the phone, I think he was a very, very intelligent, very creative individual. And just like all of us, including myself, we have different aspects of our personality and different periods in our life.
I guess the reason I ask is because there's, especially if you watch the videos of the few songs that were released as singles, you really do get the feeling that it's kind of his, for years and years he had the corporate image, and he really was trying to sell himself as an artist, and he molded himself into the songs he was releasing. And like you said, he was a chameleon. He formed himself to the music that he released. But then I think really when this was kind of his calling card back to that era, and he essentially came out, I think, with his spiritual belief and went right back to the occult. There's a lot of different things having to do with his spirituality in those videos especially, and they're veiled calling cards. And there's a lot of different forums online that kind of are trying to read into the videos, read into the lyrics of Black Star. So it's one of those things I guess I'd encourage you to take a look at it, even though the music may not be your cup of tea. I think the hidden meanings there are kind of interesting.
Now, I do know that he professed to have a great interest, and I believe was a follower of Buddhism. He did speak about that quite a few times, but I think during the latter when he first got started, and he was Ziggy Stardust, and he was all these other personalities. Like most artists, they're interested in gaining all the attention and all the notoriety that they can in the media. And he certainly was an individual who craved attention, and it, of course, created his career. But then, later years, as he had a family, and I believe a daughter and a son. Now, his son has made a movie, a science fiction movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the exact title, something to do with the moon. It's on, Amazon, Prime. He seemed to have toned down that, controversial, David Bowie, the bisexual and all of that, and, became a family man and did not seem to, communicate that much with the media. He was, the getting across to his fans through his music is what he wanted to do. He didn't need all that attention any longer. So I guess, a lot of artists get to the point where they kind of get, I was going to say bored, but maybe that's not the, maybe they do get a little bit bored too. They just figure that they've told it all, or they, it's like a lot of, actors and all, they only make appearances on TV when they have a film coming out.
I
don't know.
That's what made Black Star interesting, is that he was actually chronicling his own death. He was.
Yes.
You know.
Well, that I understand.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff we got going. Tim Beckley, we've got to wrap up here in a few minutes, but just with the concepts in this book, what were some of the interesting facets that you uncovered? Some of the stuff that really even kind of, having been there, been a part of it, watching it all, what still kind of blows your mind today?
Well, I guess it was also just the camaraderie of all the people that were involved in this. I mean, there was a great exchange of information between the artist and creative people. I know for a fact, I would hang out backstage and all, and I had the opportunity to meet a lot of these the singers and musicians and guitar players and bass players and all. And some of them had a superficial interest in the subject, but a lot of them seemed to be we had a vibe going, and quite a few of them I ended up with their phone numbers in my Rolodex, and I wish maybe I had kept in touch with some of them over the years. A lot of them, of course, have passed on. But there was a great unity between the world of music and the occult. One of my favorite songs is by the Jefferson Starship called "Have You Seen the Saucers?" And there just was that very positive vibe about all of this, which I find to be more positive than today's vibe. But maybe that's just me, because I was just kind of growing my own, wings and getting involved in this and going out on my own and so forth. But it's something that I enjoyed, and I look back with great fondness and often wish I could, kind of relive those days. But you can't go. Unless we come up with a time machine, it's kind of hard to do that.
It's always great catching up with you, man. Thank you for the interesting, fascinating stories with insights into rock and roll, the occult, and magic. It's been a great, great pleasure catching up with you.
You betcha.
All right, that's it for this week. We'll be back again next Saturday and Sunday with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. And remember, you can check me out every Monday through Friday on Midnight in the Desert, the best in Nighttime Talk Radio and Anomalous Talk as we discuss all aspects of the strange and supernatural. So make sure you check that out Monday through Friday, and always here Saturday and Sunday, the best of Paranormal Talk Radio with Tim Dennis and Dave Schrader on Beyond the Darkness, and a brand new episode of True Crime Tuesday coming up. You can subscribe and find information about each one of the programs by visiting darknessradio.com. darknessradio.com. We'll have a link up to our guest's book on today's podcast as well, so you can find it there. Thank you all. Be safe, be kind, love one another, and we'll see you again right here on Beyond the Darkness.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
L-E-T-E-N-P-C. Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.